This is the Future of Water, where we talk about all the ways in which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. Today, we're going to talk with Bluefield's Cullen Mitchell. In our quest to discuss all things water, we're going to talk about the role of changing procurement habits by people, customers, I guess businesses in some cases, and their impact on the water demand across key industries. Spoiler alert, that'd be pulp and paper and petrochem, among other things. But before we do that, let's get back into the habit and talk some news. Speaking of pulp and paper, Solenis, the global producer of specialty chemicals, was acquired last week by Platinum Equity for $5.25 billion. CDR and BASF were the two owners of Solenis, and they had been talking about divesting their positions recently, and so it happened pretty quickly. In 2019, Solenis had merged with BASF's paper and water chemicals business, which gave BASF 49% stake in the company. So it's interesting to see this happening. Solenis is going to be merged with Segura Water, which is Platinum Equity's other water portfolio company that operates or focuses on the residential pool business. Solenis, for those not in the know, competes with companies like SNF, Chimera, Nalco, among others. But it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because it's not a small deal. It's actually fairly impressive. News item number two, Cadiz announced the acquisition of a 220-mile pipeline, the Cadiz Northern Pipeline, from El Paso Natural Gas. It's getting ahead of myself. The Northern Pipeline is expected to provide new water conveyance access to supplement California's water infrastructure along an underserved east-west route, depending on some regulatory approvals. The Northern Pipeline extends southeast from California's Central Valley near Bakersfield and terminates at the company's Cadiz Ranch and its agricultural operations there. California's in the news, but don't just focus on California. Like I said in my last, or the Future Waters last podcast, episode 30, can't just shame California. There's a lot happening in the Western U.S. when it comes to water needs, drought, and so on. So it's interesting to see this being built out. News item number three, farther afield, iodine concentrations among children in Israel is reported to be 10% lower than the recommended numbers by the World Health Organization, according to a recent health ministry survey. The culprit? Desalinated water, which has become more prevalent in Israel, especially in the central region. So in the desalination process, its important elements are stripped out of the water, things like magnesium and iodine. So with more capacity planned in Israel, but also, you know, an issue when it comes to iodine levels for children, there are steps that can be taken, simple recommendations such as adding iodine to table salt. We've seen this in other markets, Denmark, Spain, Chile, United Arab Emirates. They've all adopted similar recommendations. And, you know, it's worth noting, at least in our reading, that the number of countries struggling with iodine deficiency has dropped from 113 in 1993 to 28 in 2020. So given climate change and the expected growth in desalination, yep, you heard me say it, growth in desalination opportunities, because it is insurance against drought. Keep that in mind. This is something that will need to be addressed on the back end and something to be looked out for. Three news items. There we have it. So as a reminder, sign up for Waterline, Bluefield's weekly newsletter, to receive curated news and data from our team of water experts. Two, subscribe to the Future of Water. I'm going to say it again and again and again. We want to make this a better podcast and we want to make it more informative. So don't hesitate to reach out to water experts at bluefieldresearch.com with ideas or questions. Curious minds do want to know. All right, we've gotten that done. So let's talk to Bluefield analyst Cullen Mitchell. All right, so I'm joined today by Cullen Mitchell. Cullen, long time no talk. Where are you these days?
Hey, Reese, how's it going? I'm in sunny Denver, Colorado right now.
It's, what do they say about Denver? Is it Colorado or Denver as a whole? It's the sunniest place in America because it gets over 300 days of sun a year.
Yeah, it's that rings true.
It's probably really, that's even in the winter, it's sunny. So it's probably pretty nice there. Yeah. How long are you out there for?
Just a couple more days and then coming back to Bluefield in Boston.
Nice. Well, it's cool here today, but, you know, that'll be nice. And after the heat from a week or two ago. So Cullen, we've been talking about what's the impact of COVID, what's the impact of everybody living and working at home. But what we've internally been referring to it as the Amazon effect for some time. So, and really what's the impact of all of this on water management? Can you help me or help everybody understand why we should be interested in this broader Amazon effect and its impact on water?
Yeah, definitely. So there's a couple things at play here and some big news items that are touching on it in recent days. So in June of 2021 of this year, the Singapore-based investment firm Circulate Capital just closed $14 million for its Circulate Capital Disrupt Fund, which is a companion fund to their larger $106 million Circulate Capital Ocean Fund that was launched in 2019. And the goal of that is to reduce ocean plastic. And it's been in partnership with a lot of the major food and consumer product brands that we know of, like PepsiCo, Procter & Gamble, Unilever, and Coca-Cola. And so at the same time, we're seeing some policy shifts too. So the European Union has launched their, what they're calling their plastic strategy, which is a goal to reduce and recycle 55% of all plastic packaging in that region by 2030. So pretty ambitious. And just for some context, so the Center for International Environment Law says that, has found that product packaging accounts for 40% of all global plastic demand, but only about 14% of that is recycled. So there's a lot of, I think, room for improvement there. So this tells us, you know, one, that the big multinational corporations are really starting to focus on packaging and its impact on the environment and the kind of associated brand risk that can come with that. And then, you know, Reese, you know, any sort of shift from plastic to paper packaging, kind of either way, back and forth, is going to have a big impact on water management throughout the supply chain.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting to look at sort of the evolution, or I don't know if arc is the right word. I use that phrase frequently about, you know, the story from, you know, where things started as far as customer behaviors or procurement habits from at an individual level to where we are, you know, historically to where we are now. But I guess within this context, you're highlighting, I don't know if it's corporate anti-plastic sentiment, that might be a little strong. I know there's this, it's a bit of a battleground in public. Among different industries, whether it be the petrochem industry, but also the pulp and paper sector. So I guess the question is, are you telling me that the pulp and paper industry, they could be benefiting from this anti-plastic sentiment, if you will?
Yeah, definitely. So I think what's interesting about this kind of anti-plastic sentiment that's going on is really kind of the visible nature of it. So consumer preferences are really susceptible to what they're seeing. So there's a lot of plastic in the ocean. We're seeing packaging waste pile up in trash cans, even, you know, seeing a huge plastic package shipping Amazon products for, that's like very tiny products is kind of creating this visceral reaction in consumers. In a nutshell, the arc is going from, you know, traditional brick and mortar shopping, which has packaging associated with that, but that's kind of been in flux even before the pandemic started. And then kind of in the US, especially our relationship with plastic, there's something that people have called the shale gale. So hydraulic fracturing boomed in the US over the last couple of decades or so, and that really propelled petrochem products forward in the US. But as that rise happened, there's also been a bit of a backlash. So you see stores banning plastic bags or charging for them due to really kind of this public outcry over plastic in the oceans. and the overall climate impact of producing plastics. And then we have this thing that people are calling the Amazon effect. So everyone kind of shifting from shopping in person to wanting everything delivered to them, which again was gaining traction before the pandemic, but has really been accelerated since then as well.
Yeah, I think the last point, and that's really sort of points to some of the research that you've been working on and we in Bluefield have been looking at. And that is, I mean, I think for all of us, whether you're driving down your down the street in your neighborhood or walking through your the street in your neighborhood, there seem to be Amazon boxes. And it's not just Amazon. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about the Amazon effect and, you know, what does that mean and sort of what are those trends that we're seeing?
Yeah, so we have some kind of good data to add context to this. So the U.S. Census Bureau's quarterly analysis back from May of this year estimates that e-commerce sales have increased 39.1% in the first quarter of 2021 compared to that same time last year in 2020. So this kind of growing prevalence of online purchasing and door-to-door deliveries, if you think about consumer packages, and then also like a lot of takeout food, even in the absence of the pandemic, has really accelerated this, what people are calling the Amazon effect, which is the disruption of online digital procurement in lieu of, you know, in-person purchasing. And then against that kind of movement, we're also seeing a lot of corporate sustainability and ESG initiatives from big multinational consumer product companies that are focusing on water management and supply chains across pulp and paper and petrochem verticals.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, I was looking through some notes actually earlier today and just thinking about the role of corporate sustainability or ESG initiatives, broadly speaking. And it seems to be that it really is driving a lot of activity, even beyond just the basic economics of, you know, whether it be on-site reuse, water reuse, or water management systems on site for industrial firms. So with that being said, so that's sort of the seems to be the landscape within which we're talking about, you know, everybody's at home, like I said, receiving packages, but it's not just the chicken parm that's being delivered to your house or all the widgets, whether it be detergent or dryer sheets and other stuff from the various vendors, because they're all coming in cardboard boxes or plastic bags of some form. What does this mean for water, right? And so maybe let's talk a little bit about the pulp and paper sector, because that's there's been a lot of change happening there already over time. And it's known as a heavy water user, the sector as a whole. So is it a heavy water user? What are we seeing?
Yeah, so pulp and paper is interesting because it is known as this heavy water user, but not necessarily consumer of large water volumes. So it does require high volumes of water per ton of paper produced for things like wood chip digestion, processing of fiber, even like the bleaching of papers. But on average, 85 to 95% of that water that's used in production of paper products is typically returned to the environment from where it came. So there's less of a financial risk in this industry in comparison to others that are more directly dependent on municipal wastewater treatment. But then if you look at kind of more longer term in the industry as a whole, the pulp and paper sector's water usage has actually been declining at a rate of about 3 to 5% annually over the last decade. But that kind of hides the fact that it's primarily propelled by a 70% decline in printing and writing paper since 2005. So at the same time, there have been gains in water efficiency through things like conservation, water management, and reuse at the plant level. And so while traditional paper products have been declining in sales consistently over the past couple of decades, a bright spot for the sector has been containerboard products, which is what's primarily used in the cardboard packaging that we're talking about. And so this transitioning of customer preferences towards online delivery has really spiked the demand for cardboard packaging in the last year.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to that point that that's the container board or cardboard boxes. I mean, that's a bright spot. And it seems to be the firms like Amazon is getting smarter about that. I mean, even they've received pushback. It's it still happens periodically, but it doesn't seem like it happens like it used to. You'd, as an example, you would order a bar of soap and it would come in this massive, you know, 3x3 foot size box, you know, with the bar of soap rolling around in its own box. You see less of that. They've sort of, they're trying to, I think it's my understanding, they're also using things like artificial intelligence or algorithms to at least figure out the dimensions of the product or products and then appropriately size the packaging, whether it be cardboard box or could be in some cases plastic bags, some of which are not recyclable, some are. I think the other thought was, I was looking at something not all that long ago, you know, like you said, there has been a spike in demand for packaging, but there are also other stresses on that supply chain. But the demand is driving up prices for container board. So that's benefiting the pulp and paper sector and sort of maxing out their capacity utilization, which means more water usage. But also the, I mean, think even things like glue, right? I think there's been some stresses on the price of glue for boxes, and that's related to the sourcing, the raw material sourcing, you know, from agriculture or corn in particular. But when it comes to, back to the pulp and paper industry, Cullen, when it comes to their managing water, are they using more advanced treatment solutions? Where do they stand as a whole?
Yeah, so we're kind of seeing these larger corporate sustainability trends influencing now even the pulp and paper sector water management. So we're seeing these leading firms set various water-related targets, particularly towards water conservation. So most of these firms, like a lot of heavy industries, are relying on groundwater and surface water discharge. So they're confronted less with financial pressure related to water than regulations. But then chemical treatment companies are really at the forefront of this industry's, particularly water treatment. So we have leading players like Solenis, Chimera, Ecolab, and Carita. So chemical treatment is primarily the primary water management solution for pulp and paper. And then in June, so Solenis, there was talk of BASF selling off Solenis, and that just happened recently. So Solenis is now being purchased by Segura Water.
Yeah, I think, Segura is owned by Platinum Equity, so private equity firm. So it trades hands a little bit. It's interesting to see. It will be interesting to see what happens within that space, because now Solenis is not just, you know, primarily pulp and paper, but also chemical solutions, but also they're now, I think Segura is more focused on pool water management, so residential pools. I don't know how much is commercial, but that being said, I mean, this is interesting. Like, you know, we do have clients coming to us asking about, you know, pulp and paper, to the point I think you brought up, is it doesn't consume a lot of water, and the drivers for advanced treatment, particularly in the U.S., a lot of these plants and facilities are not, they're not new. So the margins are probably a little bit tight. They have been under stress because of the declines in basic paper products, you know, but also their water stresses are a little bit different, right? I mean, they're probably more regulatory, like you said, than anything else. If you're a heavy industry and there is available water, let's say you're in the Southeast or the Northwest or in the upper Midwest, like Michigan, which is a lot of where, which is where a lot of these pulp and paper mills are, because that's where the raw pulp products are coming from more often than not, then, you know, their stresses are not, you know, necessarily, they'll reuse things for like cooling, but the process water and operations is really to treat it. And then they're returning a lot of, like you said, 10 to 15% back into the surface bodies from which it came. So it's kind of always interesting to see, you know, they're not the most advanced. They do have sustainability targets and goals, and they're a little bit admittedly vague. When we look at the numbers, I know we've looked at four or five of the leading players in the U.S. like Kimberly-Clark and International Paper to kind of get a feel for what they're looking at. And it, for good reason, is very plant specific. I think that's pretty common, but they're not very targeted in many cases. I think the other thing is that there, over the past, I'd say a couple decades, there has been the transition of the pulp and paper industry to other markets like China, right? That's a big market for pulp and paper, or paper production for other uses. Well, this is, I think, really interesting. It'll be interesting to see where this goes, because I think we all see it happening around us, and largely driven by the Internet of Things, using the buzzword, where people are more connected. You can buy things easily. E-commerce sales are up, like you pointed out. But for us, we look at it through the lens of water and what that means, and what are the alternatives. And I know that we've had clients come to us to say, you know, well, you can switch from plastic to paper, but it's not as if pulp and paper doesn't use water in its production. You know, the plastic piece is something obviously the petrochem industry will be pushing back on, as far as its viability and reliability are concerned. So we're weighing that on both ends of the equation. So what's next, Cullen? What's next on your agenda when it comes to research?
Yeah, so I'm very excited to be doing some research on digital optimization for industrial facilities. So looking at software solutions that help industrials use water more efficiently.
That'll be interesting. I know that's not an easy task, because as we know, unlike the municipal sector, the industrial sector is a bit more opaque and harder to get insights into. And I know you've been talking to a lot of companies and people within various industries. So we look forward to checking that out. And I guess maybe more importantly, you know, safe travels back to the East Coast. Summertime in the East Coast is great, but, you know, it'd be nice to have 300 days of sun a year in Colorado. Look forward to catching up soon.
Yeah. Thanks, Reese.
Before we sign off, please subscribe to The Future of Water. Give us a review on Apple Podcast. You can't do it on all the other podcast platforms. Doesn't mean you can't download them, though. Send us a note to waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com with any topic ideas you would like us to discuss. We're doing this for you, as always. So give us some good ideas and we'll hook you up. Lastly, tell a friend about it. We're still in a pandemic, so no reason not to reach out to a friend and tell them what you're doing, what you're listening to. This podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by the one and only Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, visit us at bluefieldresearch.com. Take care. Talk soon.